This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We start today with the latest on the death penalty sentence for the Boston Marathon bomber. The Department of Justice is carrying forward a Trump administration request that the Supreme Court reinstate Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev's death sentence. Now recall, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, which is here in Boston, vacated that death sentence last year due to concerns both about whether the court sufficiently addressed potential jury bias and concerns about the failure to present certain evidence during the sentencing trial. President Joe Biden spoke against the death penalty during his presidential campaign. Here at home, families of bombing victims have spoken both for and against the death penalty for Tsarnaev in the past. Several members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation remain opposed to the death penalty, and Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley has spoken out against Biden's support of this DOJ decision. So there's a lot going on. Congressman Stephen Lynch joins us now to talk about it. He represents the Massachusetts 8th District, which includes Boston's downtown, South Boston, West Roxbury, and Brockton. Congressman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you, Tiziana.
I appreciate you joining us. And Congressman, I want to do justice to the complexity here. But let me start by just asking you your reaction to the administration's choice to continue with the Trump administration's appeal to the Supreme Court to reinstate the death penalty sentence for Tsarnaev.
So at full disclosure, as a state legislator, I called for the moratorium of the death penalty in Massachusetts. This was when the Innocence Project began their work in identifying numerous people. I think there were 61 people at the time that I called for the moratorium. There were 61 people on death row that had been exonerated by DNA. So that was based on the fallibility of our justice system and the fact that we were we had innocent people on death row. This is a different case, and you're right. It is extremely complex. I think that in this case where we had a jury, review all these issues, there's no question of guilt. I think the attorneys in their opening, stipulated that Mr. Tsarnaev did, with his brother, in fact wage war against innocent civilians, used a weapon of mass destruction indiscriminately to butcher children and innocent civilians. So if there was a case that justified the death penalty, this would probably be it, right? As much as I have problems with the death penalty generally, terrorism and like I say, waging war against an innocent civilian population is a grievous offense, and what this young man did was just sheer butchery, and knowingly placed that device in the midst of innocent civilians and walked away.
Let me jump in there with you for a minute on a couple of things. First, you talked about supporting a moratorium. You're acknowledging this is different. In the aftermath of the bombing, you did support the decision by then Attorney General Holder to pursue the death penalty for Tsarnaev. As you know, what we're talking about here was a sentencing trial. And there's a lot going on because we know that there have been families of victims on both sides of this. We know that you're a longtime family friend of the Richard family. Their son Martin was killed in the attack. Their daughter Jane was severely injured. And they've opposed the death penalty for the bomber. And part of that is about moving on is the wrong word, but not keeping Tsarnaev in the public eye. And what about that? As we pursue these things, this just keeps coming back. People have to listen to this conversation again. They have to be reminded of that pain and loss. Where does that fit in the arc of justice and healing?
Well, look, I do understand Bill and Denise Richards' positions, and I respect them. They are just such good and decent people. And I understand that, this keeps the name and the incident alive. And I certainly understand what the desire to just move on. I certainly understand that, but I also understand the Department of Justice, what they're doing. And, you know, and I truly believe that Joe Biden has a position similar to my own, that, you know, he has spoken against the death penalty, and I understand that, but this is one of those cases. This is a case of terrorism. This is the worst of the worst. This was malice at its worst. This was totally reprehensible against human beings.
Do you believe then, so this was a question I did want to ask you, there are those who perceive President Biden's decision here as reversing himself on his opposition to the death penalty. There are also those who perceive this as part of his very public decision to not intervene in decisions made by the Department of Justice to allow it to be independent. Which of those two things do you think is what's happening here?
Unquestionably the latter. I think that, you know, especially following President Trump, who tried to use the Department of Justice as a tool over and over and over again for his own political benefit and, you know, to appease the base, his base. I think President Biden is trying to do just the opposite. He's trying to let the rule of law prevail here. He's trying to, you know, to send a message to his Department of Justice that he will not engineer, he will not pre-bake any results here. He won't use the Justice Department as a tool, and that he trusts their judgment.
Does that undermine later attempts by potentially President Biden himself, by his ability to support, for example, your colleague Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley's call to abolish the death penalty? If the administration supports it here, does that undermine a move later to abolish it?
I'm sure there'll be conditions on, you know, the abolishment. I think, you know, there are other matters. Somebody executes a federal judge. Is that still going to be warranting the death penalty? So, I think that this is a case that was decided by a jury in a previous administration. This has been picked up by the Department of Justice, and he wants to avoid interference. I don't think deciding prospectively whether the death penalty shall be used in the future is interfered with by the decision to allow the Justice Department to pursue this case.
I am struck by a line from a recent column that Yvonne Abraham wrote in the Boston Globe. She said, quote, "A life, even one considered worse than worthless, is never ours to take. If Biden can't draw the line here, how can he draw it anywhere?" End quote. And I just want to get your thoughts, your response to that.
Well, I think certainly the line can be drawn at any moment, you know, that the president chooses. That's in his power. I don't necessarily agree with Ms. Abraham's preposition.
So in a minute, I'm going to move on to something else and ask you just a quick question about something else. But before we go there, you know, we are in this moment where there is the arc of criminal justice and our justice system in this case. And then there is the arc of healing for us as a community. It's 2021 now, a very different time than when the jury made its decision. How do we think about... Does the arc of justice here, actually, in the conversations we have to have in this challenge and the revisit of the court cases, does it hinder our healing, or do you feel like we are on a path to healing as a Massachusetts community and an American community here that can withstand these ups and downs as the cases go on?
I'm not sure I follow you.
Well,
there's
I
a rule
guess
of law here, and the question is, or could be proposed: do we regard, you know, waging war against the civilian population? Is that something that warrants the death penalty? Or is that something that's going to be treated like any other crime?
That's really clarifying. Thank you, Congressman. And I'm sorry if that question was a little sort of unclear. Again, there's so much complexity here. Before we let you go, I do want to ask you just one question on another subject. There was another big House vote today. It was global in nature, but it's again one of those where the legacy comes home for so many who served in the military from our region. And that's the bipartisan vote to repeal the 2002 Iraq War Powers Resolution, which authorized the invasion of Iraq. You voted for authorization in 02. This now goes to the Senate, but in your view, is this the end of something? Is this the end of this expensive, deadly saga? And are we doing it also to remove the temptation for a future president to abuse it for other means? We know both Presidents Trump and Obama used it for other justifications.
I certainly think after 20 years, dear Lord, this has gone far too long. Remember, this just requires the president to come back to Congress. If they believe they need war powers authorization, that's all it requires is for the president to return to Congress to gain that authorization and to present the facts underlying that request. So, and I think that's something that should be required of every president at every opportunity. So I have voted repeatedly over at least the last 10 years eliminate the pre-existing AUMF and to require the president to come before Congress.
And that is Congressman Stephen Lynch. Congressman, I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Deanna, thank you so much. Always good to speak with you. Thank you.
Appreciate it. More now from WBUR's Boston Underwater series, and today we are going underground, into the sewers more specifically, because while Boston is an old city, part of the reason we love it, when it comes to its sewers, age can be a problem. Of the 666 miles of stormwater pipes running underneath the city, nearly half were built during the 1930s or earlier, and at least 120 miles predate World War I. Now, these pipes are actually structurally sound, but simply put, the system was not built to drain this Boston. It was built to drain a very different Boston, one with a lot less water than today's city and landscape are going to produce due to climate change, or at least are likely to produce. WBUR environmental reporter Miriam Wassum has gone deep into the topic of Boston's sewage and stormwater systems and their vulnerability to climate change. I think this is going to be so much fun to talk about. Miriam, welcome back to the show.
Oh, Tiziana, I could talk about this all day. I am thrilled to be here.
I know. Let's just get our sewer geeks on, Miriam. I'm really excited.
Let's do it.
Okay, because as it turns out, so this Boston Underwater series, it's about climate change. Mm-hmm. It's about sea level rise. And it turns out that sewers and stormwater really matter. So tell us why.
Sure. So I just want to start off by saying that the sewer system, we're talking about both stormwater and wastewater systems. These are central to making our modern society work. And the wastewater system, so like the water that disappears when you flush your toilet, is pretty safe from climate change. What we're going to talk about is the stormwater system. So that's the water that falls on your streets and houses and flows into catch basins, which are those metal grates on the side of the road. From there, it goes through underground pipes to an outfall where it's deposited into Boston Harbor or one of its tributaries. So what does this have to do with climate change? A couple things. First, as you alluded to in the opening, we're going to get some really severe storms in the future because of climate change, and they're going to drop a ton of rain in a really short period of time. And our pipes were designed to handle a certain amount of water, approximately 5 inches in 24 hours. If that capacity is exceeded, things just start to back up. So one of the experts I talked to for this story, UMass Boston professor Ellen Douglas, put it to me this way. She said, imagine that the stormwater system is like a funnel that you're holding under the faucet.
And as long as the flow coming out of the faucet is not greater than the flow that can come out of the end of the funnel, everything will be fine. But if you increase the amount of water coming out of that faucet, eventually you're going to have water overflowing the funnel. That's exactly what happens in a storm drain system.
So climate change is kind of like turning up the water pressure on that funnel or on the sink.
Okay. So to a couple of things you said there. First, the sewer and the stormwater systems, we're talking about stormwater here. They are, as I understand it, somewhat, is interdependent the right word?
Yes and no. It kind of, I don't want to get like too into the weeds here. Most
too
of
into
the
pipes here.
Too into the pipes, but I will. In most of the city, they are separate systems. So they are separate pipes going, they're actually probably controlled by different agencies. The MWRA handles most of the wastewater. Okay. They are separate. There are a couple exceptions where they are combined, but all of that water is going to a treatment plant anyways. So when we're talking about the stormwater system backing up, we're not talking about sewage. We're talking about, I mean, there could be other gross things in there, but.
And how old is our system, like the underground network, et cetera, for stormwater drainage?
So that actually goes back to, well, it depends on where you start. But as I wrote in one of my pieces, the stormwater system in Boston is actually older than the city itself. So, Right. Yeah, when European colonists first settled the area in the 1600s, they very quickly realized that when it rains, the clay-rich soil of Boston doesn't absorb water very well, and it just created like a lot of mud. So people got creative and started creating underground channels to direct stormwater to the harbor. And by underground channels, I mean that people were just like literally digging up the public streets and making these brick-lined channels to the harbor. And over time, it got chaotic. And then it got gross because people started connecting their backyard privies or outhouses to the system. And this meant that sewage was just deposited all over tidal flats in the city. And, you know, I quote a city report from the 1870s that said, the problem of bad odors was so bad it could arouse the sleeping, terrify the weak, and nauseate and exasperate everyone.
Yes. So, and that article, it's a hoot. It's actually worth reading. But you're reassuring us that that's not where we are today, right? So
No. Now
we've got this durable system. But as you say, we've got this problem of this funnel, right? More water than the funnel of the system might be able to handle. So what are the specific threats now? I mean, how does this manifest? What are planners in Boston worried about?
Yeah. And I should also add that, you know, so the turning up the pressure on the water is one thing. There's another part of that too, and that's that it has to do with storm surge and sea level rise. So just quickly, if you picture the outfall of the pipe, sort of the end of that funnel draining into Boston Harbor, if it's low tide and the water level in the harbor is below the pipe, things can flow out easily. But if the water level is higher from either sea level rise or storm surge, it's going to block that pipe, which makes it harder, if not impossible, for stormwater to drain. And in some scenarios, you might actually get water backflowing into the system. So that's sort of the second side of the pipe problem.
Got it.
But in terms of what the city is worried about, I mean, road flooding is a really big one. We already see major transportation routes like Morrissey Boulevard that get shut down for flooding. And street closures are frustrating and have an economic cost, but they can also be a really big public safety threat because, you know, if first responders can't get to someone, we can be talking about a life and death situation here.
All right. So we have both the obvious environmental problems. We have that problem of public safety. Who is in charge now of trying to fix this?
Yeah. So after Hurricane Harvey in 2017, the city of Boston, they, you know, sort of a wake up call. They were like, oh my goodness, extreme flooding. What are we going to do? And you have Climate Ready Boston that's handling a lot of the stuff dealing with how we're going to keep sea level rise and storm surge out of the system. And on the flip side, you have the Boston Water and Sewer Commission working on figuring out how we can make sure that stormwater can drain at the same time. So those two city agencies are the ones really handling this.
Okay. And just a reminder for listeners, Hurricane Harvey was over 60 inches of rain in a short time in Houston in 2014. Is that right?
Yes. Did I say 2017?
Okay. No. I'm just making sure we've got it right. Okay. So now, sit tight, Miriam, because I'm going to add another voice. I've got Sanjay Sate here, who is the climate resilient who is the climate resilience program manager for the city of Boston. Sanjay, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So it's great to have you. You've heard Miriam and I talk this through. Miriam's kind of educating me as we go along. Anything else we need to understand about the problem?
I mean, it's a big problem. And thankfully, we've been doing a lot to get our hands around it. So, you know, Miriam's pieces have been great at really providing a lot of context to readers to understand how interconnected the system is. You can't just think about rain. You can't just think about wastewater. You can't just think about sea level rise. They all kind of have to come together in an integrated manner. So that's what the work we do. It is fun work, and it's also very challenging work. So no, I think you have it exactly right. And then Miriam, you've been doing a great job with these pieces. Also digging into history. I loved reading the pieces about the history of Boston's sewage system.
Thank you.
And there, you can find that story at WBUR.org, listeners, and there's some fantastic pictures from the construction of these systems in that story, too. Sanjay, so I'm imagining what it would take just to deal with pipes under my house, right? And now we're talking about a city. How do we get ready for increased rainfall, rising sea levels, other effects of climate change in this kind of infrastructure? And what are we doing right now?
Yeah, so, I mean, how do we deal with it? I think, you know, the way that you deal with the funnel problem is you deal with both sides of the funnel, like Miriam was saying. So there's a range of things you can do to limit the impact that a lot of rain has. And cities like Houston are really trying to double down on this because they realize that if they don't figure out stormwater, they're going to have many more floods to come. So, you know, there are solutions like storage. You can store the water on a site underneath a building. You can slow down the water, and you can reduce the amount of water you put into the system at any given time. Like Miriam said, you know, when we're talking about 5.25 inches over a 24-hour period, if you store the water, that's effectively like reducing the amount of water that needs to go into the system. So you're slowing it down, and that's a really good method to protect folks without coming up with very complex engineering solutions.
Okay, so I also know, Sanjay, that you've said that those who are already vulnerable in Boston are even more vulnerable to stormwater flooding. There's an equity and justice issue to this and dimension to this too. Talk a little bit more about that. Who's most at risk and why?
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up. I mean, you know, the city of Boston is going to be judged not just on how we protect or not just on, you know, reducing emissions or making sure that we're resilient, but on how we do it. And we have a lot of lessons we can pull from, both from our own history and from the history of other major changes in American cities, where we might not have lived up to our highest aspirations. And we see that in who has tree cover and how they experience heat. We see that in who has facilities sited next to them that pollute their air. This is a story that's been around for a long time. And when we talk about climate change, we have an opportunity to not make those same mistakes. And we have an opportunity to also correct some of those mistakes. And I think when we think about who's most impacted by climate change, it's not just about where the water goes or where the heat is, but it's about the person. And putting the person at the center of the climate crisis really helps you understand what we can do today and what we can do now to make sure that folks are protected. So, you know, when I talk about putting a person at the center, it's really about understanding what can any person do when they have an impact, like a flood or a heat wave, to protect themselves and their families, or how sensitive are they to it, rather than just, do they live in a hot building? And I think that's the direction that good climate work is going in the United States, and Boston is doing that work.
Before I turn back to Miriam, you said there are also opportunities here to correct some of those mistakes. Give one example.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so currently the city of Boston is undertaking an analysis of all of the heat impacts that we experience both today and in the future. And what we know about that is those heat impacts, meaning who experiences the worst of a heat wave and lives in a really hot neighborhood, that tends to coincide with neighborhoods that were redlined in the past. And redlining just means when financial institutions wouldn't lend to residents and public sector folks wouldn't invest in neighborhoods that had specific racial or ethnic compositions. And so when you think about correcting the wrongs. It's about understanding who's disproportionately affected by climate change and how do we ensure that, you know, no one bears more of their fair share of all of these impacts that we're going to have to be adjusting with and adapting to over the coming years.
And Sanjay, briefly, is there anything individuals can do, or is this really a systems level issue?
There's so much that individuals can do to protect themselves and their families and be a part of the solution here. When we think about heat and stormwater, there are so many opportunities to do something on your own property, or even if you're a renter, to do things that can help cool down your building, your community, and your neighborhood. You can look at things like painting things with a more reflective coating. A lot of roofs in Chinatown, for instance, are very dark and they absorb a lot of heat. So there's things from paint to screens to shading to rain barrels and French drains, and there's all these things that you could pull off a shelf today. You could go to Home Depot today and you could figure out how you could have an impact. And we want to make sure that folks understand that it's not just up to the city, it's not just up to the property owner on the waterfront. It's really up to all of us to make this work.
All right, Miriam, back to you now. What are you going to watch for next?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all watching to see what the city does. And jumping off of what Sanjay was saying, you know, one of the solutions is to create more green spaces because that absorbs rainwater and street trees and all sorts of plants that can reduce the amount of rainwater flowing into the system really quickly. But on the flip side of that, there are some places that are going to need engineering solutions. And so we'll be watching, you know, the city of Boston is currently undertaking a process to assess the vulnerability of its 208 storm water outfalls and then trying to figure out solutions. So they're really ahead of the curve nationally on this.
We will keep watching with you. WBUR environmental reporter Miriam Wasser and Sanjay Sait, Climate Resilience Program Manager for the City of Boston. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yet this hour, President Biden is expected to sign a bill making June 19th or Juneteenth a federal holiday. And this week, the Commonwealth will mark our first Juneteenth statewide. Juneteenth symbolically marks the official end of slavery in the country and marks the date in 1865 that enslaved people in Texas were notified of the Emancipation Proclamation, which had been signed more than 2 years earlier. For the rest of the show, we want to talk about what it means to celebrate or observe Juneteenth thoughtfully. How do we make sure we're celebrating in ways that honor June 19th's legacy? Pull up a chair. Join this conversation. 1-800-423-8255. Are you observing Juneteenth this year? Is it your first time? Is it one of many? Has it been celebrated for generations in your family? What are you going to do to observe the day? And what do you think it means to observe Juneteenth thoughtfully? Please share your traditions, ask your questions, share your thoughts. The number again, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Guest with us now. First, Kelly Carter Jackson. She's an associate professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Also, Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Professor Carter Jackson, Reverend Mariama, welcome back to both of you.
Hi.
It's great to have you both. Have the two of you, I don't think the two of you have ever been on the show together before.
Not that I know.
Yeah, no, this is great. Hi.
Hello.
It's going to be a great conversation. So, Professor Carter Jackson, actually, would the two of you mind, do you mind for purposes of this conversation if I call you Kelly and Mariama?
Oh, please call me Kelly.
Great. Great. All right. So, Kelly, I'm going to start with you. In your words, what is Juneteenth?
Oh, man. Juneteenth is what a lot of Black people refer to as the Black 4th of July. It represents the final enslaved people receiving their freedom in Texas. Over 250,000 enslaved people were freed on June 19th in Texas. The 13th Amendment doesn't pass until December of 1865. But once the war is over, the final slaves that get note that the war is over happens on this day.
So, Mariama, the sort of a big sweeping question and follow-up to what Kelly just told us, why is it important that we are officially celebrating it this year here in the Commonwealth?
Well, I think part of this is an acknowledgement that the traditional party line that we tell ourselves about our nation is far more complex. And just sort of celebrating July 4th and saying, you know, we should all just fit into that misses the fact that the history of this country is complex for a lot of us, and that July 4th wasn't real freedom for a lot of us. That while some people were celebrating their freedom, some of us were, our ancestors were working the fields. Mm-hmm. And so for me, Juneteenth is the moment when we really were all free. Now, of course, there's a lot more complexity about the work that it takes from for something to be, to move from being theory to reality. I mean, part of the excitement about Juneteenth, somebody asked, why don't we just celebrate the Emancipation Proclamation? And in my church, we also do that. We have what's called Watch Night. But the reality is that when President Lincoln said we were free, it wasn't actually really true for everybody. Mm-hmm. So Juneteenth is a reminder that it's not just the moments at which the people at the top are free, but not until everybody is free are we really free.
We are talking with Reverend Mariama White Hammond and Professor Kelly Carter Jackson about thoughtful observation and celebration of Juneteenth. Call with your plans for celebrating Juneteenth this year with your questions about how to do that thoughtfully or thoughts about what comes next. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Kelly, for those who are marking Juneteenth maybe for their first time this year, what mm-hmm. what do you advise keeping in mind? What's important to keep in mind beyond the ways that we celebrate together in community, mm-hmm. you know, food and togetherness?
You know, it's funny that we're talking about this. I just penned an op-ed about this very idea of how we sort of reconcile history and memory. And I think oftentimes memory is, you know, the superficial surface or symbolic aspects of a holiday. But for something like Juneteenth, you really cannot separate the history out from the symbolism. And what I want people to keep in mind is that this history is really clouded in death. It's clouded in delay, a delay that came 2 years later for enslaved people. And I want them to be able to hold these ideas of delay and delight in both hands. I think we can do that. I think we can celebrate and have barbecues or parades, but I think we can also pause to understand, you know, the gravity of this history and the history of our country and how for so long we have been a country, actually longer than a country of slaves than we have been a country of free people. And that's what I want people to really take a moment and sit with.
So then, Mariama, how do we sit together in community, in celebration, but also observation and respect, regard for the things that Kelly just laid out?
Yeah, well, I hope my plans on Saturday might maybe kind of try to capture that. We, our church is coming together. We're doing a ritual at the MFA. And for us, we're balancing the reality of Juneteenth with the fact that it's Pride Month and the fact that for us in our liturgical calendar, it's Pentecost. And so really looking at this idea of liberation, that we believe is part of the symbols of the Holy Spirit, the liberation for Black people that still is not fully realized. And we also talk about liberation for our LGBT brothers and sisters, because as part of a church that is not yet affirming of LGBT folks, there is still unfinished business. So I think for us, again, as like Kelly was saying, you've got to hold that complexity to the both the beauty and the brokenness. And that's true for each of us as individuals, but it's also true of our society. There's so many things to celebrate and there are things to critique. And so, you know, I'll start off with that ritual and holding that ritual. And then I've got some barbecues and some time in the garden, and then I'm going to see some kids play basketball and then going to a protest. So the day is full of lots of expressions. And for me, they all are actually a part of how we lean into mm-hmm. the celebration. The evening ends with the celebration of an elder who's retiring mm-hmm. after years of social justice work. So I think for me, it is about leaning into all of the aspects of life, the joy, the pain, the progress, the work to still be done. I think Juneteenth, for me, holds all of those complexities, maybe more than any other holiday I can think of.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, I want to pick up with you, but we do have some calls coming in. So let's pick up our first call real quick. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. Keith is on the line from Lynn. Keith, go ahead.
Hello, how are you? Thank you, Tiziana. Thank you, Mariama, if I'm saying your name correctly. And thank you, Kelly, for your knowledge and wisdom. Appreciate that. I just want to say the way we honor these people and what we have done is teaching each other knowledge, wisdom, and the understanding of what happened. Conversations when we do have these barbecues, conversations at the tables, and they also just can't just happen yearly. You know what I mean? It has to be done every day or hopefully, weekly, if anything, you know what I mean? And this is just a start. A lot of people are going to be fresh and new about it. So my suggestion, even with my own families, I won't overwhelm anyone. You know, I'm a historian buff myself. And sometimes I think when we find out new knowledge and things, sometimes our excitement or our enthusiasm tends to overwhelm people and they don't really get the gist of what we're trying to say because we are so enthused. So I think everyone should just take it in stride in how they want to celebrate it, really get the understanding of what it is and how wrong it was that it was 2 years later after the emancipation and understanding the, if I want to say those necessary evils of those men to even suppress that, you know, and to finally to have that come to light.
Thank you for that call, Keith. And so Kelly, I'm going to come back to you there because there's a lot in what Keith said, but there is mm-hmm. both, there's this idea of unfinished business, which is a phrase, Mariama, you used a minute ago. And I want to come to the duality of our unfinished business today and also the idea that after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, as you noted, Kelly, 2.5 years later, and there are people who still don't know about the emancipation. So how do we hold marking a moment and marking unfinished business all at the same time?
It's difficult because I don't want to downplay the joy of this moment. You know, enslaved people were rejoicing and rightly so. And this is a moment I think that we can celebrate. But the reality, the historical reality is that also that within months, certain years of the end of the Civil War, racial violence is exploding all over the country. We have racial massacres that are taking place. Union troops have to be kept in place in order to keep out the Klan and white supremacists that are trying to target Black communities, that are trying to educate themselves and build their churches and build their schools and build their communities. And so in a lot of ways, the freedom of Black people, especially the success of Black people, has made them a target. And I think we see this, you know, so clearly in like Tulsa. We just celebrated the 100th anniversary of Tulsa. And one of the things that was so remarkable about this place was that its success made it a target of the Klan. And so one of the things
Just Black Wall Street in Tulsa
Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I'm constantly trying to reckon with is that as Black people strive for excellence, as we strive to improve ourselves, to assert our humanity, that is constantly going to be met with a racial backlash. And we are still experiencing that racial backlash today. We've seen it with the election of Barack Obama. You see it with the election of even Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. We see this every single time Black people excel. There is a backlash that is often violent and forceful. And we're still living in that moment.
So a couple of things. First, I just want to make us aware, I referenced at the beginning of this conversation that we are awaiting President Biden to sign this bill. That signing ceremony has begun. We'll kind of keep an eye on it in the background. Vice President Harris has been speaking. So we'll come back and forth to that because it's interesting that that's unfolding as we're having this conversation. I want to go back to the phones here. We've got Jack on the line, the number 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack's on the line in Waltham. Jack, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to say hi to your guest, Mariama. I was your father's classmate. We just celebrated our 50th reunion. Hello?
We're here, Jack. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Yeah, I used to teach African-American history at Emerson, and I think what is important is for us to take our minds back to that date in 1865. And I would surmise that the majority of slaves knew they were free, but the slave masters had not acknowledged it. They had tried to keep it from us. And I would think of it as a time when actually the Emancipation Proclamation began to be enforced and acknowledged in Texas. The majority of slaves knew they were free, but their masters wouldn't let them go.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that, Jack. I appreciate that. And Mariama, I think I heard you actually kind of make us. Yeah, go.
I was just going to say, adding to that, I learned this from a friend from New Jersey. Lest we think that Texas was the only state, New Jersey also did not abolish slavery till 1865. And actually, I believe they rejected the 13th Amendment when it came through. So it wasn't like it was Texas was the only holdout state and everybody else was ready to let go of slavery.
Yeah, that's true. So, it wasn't even until 2013 that I think Mississippi actually ratified the 13th Amendment in their state. So there's a lot of history there.
So I want to pivot, and we've been talking about a lot of depth. I also want to pivot to the celebration part. And at one point earlier, Mariama, you talked about the barbecue you were going to go to. Kelly, you laughed about that. We do, when we celebrate, we break bread together. We gather as family and community. Where are the ways, what are the ways to mark also some joy in this moment? How to do that thoughtfully? And what are some of the traditions that have been handed down across generations to do that? Kelly, maybe you can start us off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm really excited for Juneteenth this year. My children have been too small to sort of understand it. And I think this is really the first year in which I can do some fun things with them and talk to them in ways that they'll understand. They're 7 and 4. And so we're going to do all of the traditional things. We're going to eat red food. We're going to have watermelon and strawberries, and we're going to make red velvet cake. And, you know, we're going to talk about the symbolism of the day and the history of the day. And, you know, I got them coloring books to color in the Juneteenth flag. Like, I really want this to be something for them that is fun and enjoyable, and where they too have a history of this. They acknowledge this as part of their history, but they also see the wonderful ways that we can celebrate what it means to be Black in this country, and how even though racism is terrible, Blackness is not. And so today and all throughout the year, we really get a chance to celebrate it. But today just feels like a collective social celebration in which so many people can gather for the same purpose to acknowledge this moment.
And before I go back to Mariama, Mariama, remind us, red is an important color in Juneteenth for a bunch of reasons. It's a layered color, really. Talk about that a little bit. Kelly, sorry.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were talking to Mariama.
No,
the red
ahead.
Is very symbolic. So the red represents several things. It represents the blood that was shed during slavery. It represents perseverance and resilience. And in some ways, it just acknowledges that this path, this past and path that we're on, is a hard one. But the color red is meant to represent like boldness, and all of the food that is consumed traditionally on this day has some symbolism towards red, the color red. So like I said, watermelon or strawberries or red velvet cake. I just got a red great recipe for beet cornbread. It's cornbread that you make with beets so that it's red. I've been watching High on the Hog and getting inspired on Netflix. There's a new series that spends a whole episode talking about the recipes of Juneteenth. And red plays a very important color.
I'm going to grab one more call and then I'll, oh, go ahead. No, go ahead, Reverend Mariama.
I was just going to say, one of my reasons for loving Juneteenth is that red is also my favorite color. So Kelly, you have to give me that recipe.
Yeah, I will.
Is it one that can be public, Kelly? Can we put it on our website if you send it to
us? I think so. I just got it off Google, so yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. So actually, Mariama, with our limited time, I'm actually going to turn back to you because I want to pick up this other thread. You talked, as you were talking about what your day is going to look like on Saturday, you talked about the fact that your congregation is also addressing some of the unfinished business around the LGBTQ community. And, you know, one of the things as Pride has gone mainstream over the last several years, one of the criticisms has been that in mainstreaming it, it's been sanitized. It's been co-opted corporately. Mm-hmm. As we have President Biden basically at the podium right now making a speech before he makes Juneteenth a national holiday, any concern about the mainstreaming of a holiday and the ways that sometimes sanitizes the deep meaning of it?
Well, yes. And I think part of the reason that happened with Pride is because we've forgotten the story of Stonewall, a uprising, a action of police brutality, predominantly against Black trans women. And because that story has been missing from the conversation, it has just turned into a celebration. And I think the importance of Juneteenth is making sure that we tell our children, that we all tell the story of why Juneteenth exists. It's okay to have a good time. I am looking forward to doing some line dancing. I am looking forward to the stepping and strolling from the Black Greek groups and the music and the family. But what is important is that we do not forget that our joy is so beautiful because it comes despite the level of suffering we've had. And I think a lot about what the Bible often says to the children of Israel. It says, you know, to remember your story, to write it on your door, to make sure that you teach your children. And so what's important about Juneteenth, there's nothing wrong with having a good time. It's a part of that day, but we have to make sure the story stays alive.
Hmm. Kelly, 10 seconds, one last thought from you.
I can't echo that enough. I think I agree with all that was just said. We have to be able to hold the symbolic and the substantive in the same hand, and history and memory in the same hand, and acknowledge that this is a painful past, but it's also a beautiful one if we choose to work to make it that way.
All right. And just to kind of close us out, moments ago, President Biden called Juneteenth, quote, a day of profound weight and profound power, a day in which we remember the moral stain and the terrible toll that slavery took on the country and continues to take, end quote. What a conversation. Kelly Carter Jackson, Associate Professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College, and Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.